stocks on Wall Street took a breather Wednesday as investors digested more news on the trade front. All three indexes ended the day little changed, struggling to keep the momentum after reaching record highs. Markets took a hit midday after Reuters reported that a meeting between U.S. President Donald Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping to sign an interim trade deal could be delayed until December.
Two former Twitter employees were charged on Wednesday with spying for Saudi Arabia by digging up private user data and giving it to Saudi officials in exchange for payment. That's according to a complaint filed in San Francisco by the U.S. Justice Department, which said they have also charged a third man from Saudi Arabia who worked for the Saudi royal family.
Boeing appears to be pinning its hopes for a rebound from the 737 MAX fiasco on a $1 billion investment in pilot safety training initiatives. Sources tell Reuters the training program is still being developed and will roll out over years and will launch after the plane resumes flights. Boeing is trying to rebuild trust with airlines, passengers, and regulators around the world after two 737 MAX crashes killed 346 people.
WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the program. Today is Thursday. It's November the 7th, and it's 5:10 in the morning. Thank you for tuning in for another edition of The Opening Bell. We've put together a really good broadcast for you today. We'll focus in on savings and wealth management in our first segment this morning. It's Thought Leader Thursday, and Jason Bonet is here, a Senior Vice President and Portfolio Manager at Whitnell, which is part of Associated Bank. We'll bring in Jason here momentarily. A little bit later in the program, we'll have one of the lead climate researchers at the World Research Institute Global Climate Center. Andrew Light will be here. He's a distinguished senior fellow there, and we'll talk about the U.S. pulling out of the Paris Climate Accord, and some other climate issues impacting the economy this morning at about 5:38. But first, let's begin on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk. Futures are pointing toward a positive open this morning. As you heard there in the montage, there's some news about the U.S.-China trade situation that's fueling markets here in the United States and elsewhere. Dow futures are up 152 points, nearly a half a percent. S&P futures are up nearly 13, also about a half a percent. NASDAQ futures are up about a half a percent as well. As we look around the rest of the globe, markets are all green in Asia as the trading day comes to an end there, up just fractionally in Tokyo, up nearly 158 points in Hong Kong. That's more than a half a percent. Numbers flat in China this morning. And in Europe, markets are in the green as well. In London, up by nearly a quarter. In Germany, up by nearly three quarters. And in France, up by nearly a quarter as well. Oil is trading at $57.08 a barrel. The news on trade this morning is mixed, and we'll try to tell you as much of it as we know right now. It appears that the U.S. and China have come to some sort of agreement, at least in principle, on removing some existing tariffs. It will be apparently done in phases over the next couple of weeks, but there are some conflicting reports from the Chinese state media this morning that says that there will be no immediate tariff removal and no trade deal. Saying that trade, that the tariff removals must happen simultaneously. The U.S. had earlier said that the U.S. and China had agreed to remove those tariffs in phases. So the devil will be in the details here as we learn more about this. As you heard in the montage, the meeting between President Trump and the Chinese president looks like it might slip until December at the earliest. Also this morning, we're learning a couple of stories about technology. You heard about the Twitter situation this morning. There's also a story about Samsung TVs. If you have one of the older versions of Samsung TVs, you might want to upgrade this holiday. The company has confirmed that some subscribers with older models of those smart TVs might not be able to stream Netflix after December 1st. Apparently, there's some technical limitations. Netflix isn't listing the models affected, but says all members will be notified about the alternative devices that can be used. Same situation with Roku. Those notifications have apparently already gone out. Let's begin this morning with Thought Leader Thursday. Jason Bonet is here, Senior Vice President, Portfolio Manager at Whitnell, which is part of Associated Bank. Jason, good morning. Welcome to the Opening Bell.
Good morning.
I want to begin by introducing you to our listeners. You're a new thought leader. Tell us about yourself, what you do at Whitnell.
Yeah. So Jason Monet, I'm a senior vice president. I'm a portfolio manager at Whitnell. I'm really tasked with helping to assist in client portfolio reviews from the investment side, coming up with asset allocations, investment manager selection, and really monitoring kind of the macroeconomic economy so we can make the best investment decisions for our clients.
So that in the real world, that would be choosing the right stocks, the ones that are going to pay the most, right?
Yeah. Obviously, we always have to keep risk in mind as well. But yeah, trying to find the best returning stocks for the intermediate term for our clients with the, you know, the most appropriate risk level.
What's the how challenging is that? I mean, in the current environment where we see most stocks up, where we've had this really good market, it's probably pretty easy, but it's not always that way, is it?
No, it's been quite challenging, and I think that's one of the things over my my career we've had to really come up with a cohesive philosophy that helps you to kind of come up with a framework for what is a good stock and will be something that outperforms over time. Mm-hmm. And so one of the reasons I joined the firm was my philosophy was completely aligned with the current chief investment officer, David Peckinpah, and we both just had exactly the same philosophy in how to think about stocks, even down to the level of valuations and things like that. So mm-hmm. having that that framework for success, and also being kind of intellectually honest to know when you need to flex for a new world like negative interest rates and
sure.
things like that.
Yeah, which may be coming. That may be around the
it's
corner.
It's here, coming. Yeah. We'll see what happens more.
So let's see how the sausage is made. It's not very often we get to go behind the scenes like this. Talk to us about the process.
Yeah.
You don't have to name specific stocks, but tell us how you go about it.
Right. I think, first and foremost, we're long-term investors. That being said, we have to monitor the overall macro economy. Funny thing, if we don't head into a recession, 90% of the time, markets are positive. And it's only really when we hit a recession that markets go negative, except for that 10% of the time, for instance, 2018, mm-hmm. a year ago this time, that would be a good instance of that. So we focus on the macroeconomic outlook inside of the economy, and we can't predict every single one. But there are companies who have durable moats around their business that enables them to kind of be able to grow regardless of the environment. In a good environment, they can grow more. In a bad environment, they can still outpace the overall market. And we really look for companies which have high cash generating capabilities and can basically grow earnings over 8% per year, because we think over the long term, the S&P 500 is averaged about 8% per year return. And if we can kind of generate those, we'll outperform the S&P 500. And if you just clip that through, you can see some significant returns for your portfolio over the intermediate term.
How do you do that? I'm guessing you pay really close attention to the earnings reports and the earnings calls, and you kind of do deep dives on these companies, don't you?
That's right. Yeah. So my background has been in equity research and equity portfolio management. So I'm someone who really comes from the bottoms up. We look at themes, and we look at, earnings and management teams and constantly listening to earnings conference calls, speaking with companies, and really doing kind of the proper due diligence. And by doing that, you can find companies that match kind of your investment philosophy, and then really use each quarter really as more of a reiteration of that investment thesis aligning with the philosophy.
I'm guessing there are some stocks that are probably outside of the world you deal in. I'm thinking of some cheap stocks that might be out there. Probably none of the stocks that are just making their initial public offering, right?
Yeah, no. Fortunately, not. I suppose this year. It's been a wild year to watch this year with Uber and Lyft and some of these other, the WeWork issues, if you will. But no, we will monitor those, because we do think of disruptive market entrants as an opportunity. I mean, I think if you go back a few years ago, Facebook came public, and I remember that being a pretty soiled IPO, and within 6 months after that, it being down materially. But yet, they've kind of come up and been the dominant advertising play on the mobile, right? And so you can't write companies off, and you just have to keep monitoring things every, call it, 3 months or so. But we will watch those things. But yeah, typically our portfolio is going to not have a fresh IPO in the mix, if you will.
What has the trade war done to the work you do? I guess it's made your job more challenging, right?
It has and it hasn't. So a lot of the companies we own, again, we're in them for the longer term. So if you don't think that you're going to see a complete degradation of the business model in the intermediate term, the trade war ends up being just noise for a one-year deal. That said, I think it has created a bunch of kind of winners and losers in the intermediate term. And each time that we have positive news on the trade side, you see these stocks move significantly higher. And then each time, you know, there seems to be another tweet of some sort, things kind of come back to earth. So it has been, you know, noise, if nothing else. I do think that ends up being one of the biggest focal points for the macroeconomy as we head into 2020, though. But a lot of our companies, you know, they could be doing better if people were a little bit more excited, but they're doing just fine as they are today.
You mentioned last year at this time when we saw stocks fall at the end of the year. Do you see anything currently happening in the undercurrent that we might see that happen again in December?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a complicated market to look at right now, right? I mean, if you look at it, you know, you have tariffs, you have trade wars, you have political, you have, you know, repo rate adjustments, you have federal, you know, the Fed rate cuts, you have stimulus going on, you have negative yields in Europe, Brexit's happening. So, yeah, all of those things are, you know, potential, you know, issues, if you will. But I think as we look into next year, we actually think we're starting to level out. And from a fundamental perspective, assuming we get some positive, you know, or not more negative impact on the trade war, we think that we could actually see upside into 2020 from a fundamentals perspective.
Let's talk a little bit about your background and the transition from where you were dealing with the large cap, the big corporate stuff, transitioning to Whitnell, where your focus is a little different. Talk to us about what that's been like.
Yeah, it's been really interesting. So I joined Whitnell back in June, and it's been eye-opening, right? My prior life, I was a portfolio manager on large institutional mutual funds. And, you know, to be honest, you had one mandate, and it was find really good stocks within your mandate and have them outperform their benchmark. And you did that against a 1% fee or something like that. So you typically tried to get 2 to 3% above your S&P 500 or whatever benchmark that is. And since joining Whitnell, you know, whether we choose to invest into internal equities or we go somewhere else, there's no incremental fee. So one of the things I've had as an aha moment for me is there's no internal cost for individual stocks that we manage. So if we can provide outperformance within our, you know, individual stocks for our clients, then we can gain significant excess performance for our clients for zero fees. It used to be transaction costs, but not even that is an issue anymore on commissions. So that's the first thing. Secondarily, I'll sheepishly say this, but you cared about your turnover in your portfolio, but most active portfolios run turnover between 40 to 80% of the portfolio per year. That can add a bunch of significant tax consequences. And I'm not going to speak for everyone, but I don't like to pay a penny more to the government if I don't have to in taxes. And what you find is you have some of these clients who have, you know, very, very long-term high gains in their portfolio, and we have the ability to kind of, you know, position around that, if you will. So I think it becomes much more tax efficient as well. And then I have to tell you the story about, you know, what we dealt with recently. Being on the high net worth side, you have really individual clients with just, you know, individual issues. And recently we had an executive who was looking to leave his company. And, you know, fortunately over time, he built up a lot of stock in the company and basically wanted to somehow diversify that, but not pay the capital gains that he had made, fortunately, over his time and tenure at the firm. And the government allows you to do a qualified replacement where you can sell that share to the employee stock ownership plan. But you can have to buy effectively U.S.-based stocks or bonds, you know, basically reinvesting back in the United States. But the caveat is if you sell any of those ever, then you materialize whatever capital gains had been there. So our client, healthy, young 60-year-old guy who was hoping to live till, you know, 30-plus years, hopefully, but his goal was to have this go through until death where if you pass away with this, you get a step up in the cost basis and you never pay any gains, and you can just give it to the heirs on the account. So we were tasked with coming up with investments for the next 30 years.
Wow.
Which was really intellectually stimulating, analysis. But at the same time, it made me scratch my head about what would we have done 30 years ago, right? In 1989, there was no Amazon, there was no Facebook, there was no Google. So it's a completely different phenomenon. And so we had a really, unfortunately, we were able to look at our investments philosophy and feel like a lot of these names are names that are going to be around 30 years from now that will hopefully have continued to outperform their market because of the unique ability they have. So it ended up being a fun exercise, hopefully very value-added for our client, but something that I never would have come across on the institutional side.
Yeah, and in 30 years, we can maybe go back and check the math on it and check to see whether your crystal ball works.
Yeah, let's pencil that in if
that'll
you want.
That'll be fun. You know, you mentioned the fee part of this, and you know, we've seen anybody who watches business news on a regular basis, we see all of these companies cutting their fees, cutting the cost of doing business, and nothing's free, right? I mean, isn't that the lesson we learn? And why should we pay attention to perhaps some of the things that might be, I don't want to say the dark side of that business, but some things people may not be aware of, investors may not be aware of?
Yeah, there's been a number of new articles coming out and new businesses changing, right? I mean, obviously, you had Robinhood, which was kind of the Trojan horse, if you will, for the no-fee accounts. We've also seen Schwab coming out eliminating their brokerage fees. And recently, you're starting to see ETFs, which used to be still fairly negligible fees, be completely free. It does create a conflict at some point, because what ends up happening is they have to make their money one way or the other, right? I mean, you have a cost of capital in some form or fashion, and if you can't do it the proper way, then you have to find an alternative. And so what we found with Robinhood was they were allowing no trade commissions, no low fee management, and they were selling all the orders just down the street here to Citadel. And so they basically took it, and they were the market makers. And it actually was kind of beneficial for the clients there, because Citadel has massive vision in the markets and can go through and probably get a tighter spread, if you will, to what you buy over a traditional exchange. But you're really kind of limiting yourself. And a lot of people didn't even know that they never were touching the actual markets. They were going through a large hedge fund or another option. Conversely, there are other things which, I feel like more and more, you mentioned the IPOs earlier, but people are trying to grow and get their tentacles around you, right? So get you in today with a free thing. And yet maybe years from now, all of a sudden start saying, hey, you're locked in, you have all these products with us, now you're stuck. Now let's start monetizing you, right? So I think there are potential risks down the line.
The old bait and switch, as it were.
Right? Yeah, exactly. Right. So those are the things. I mean, I think in terms of potential issues, I'm someone who believes, I'm someone who prefers value, right? I always would like to get more for less. But at the same time, there is a part of it that says you pay what you get. Yeah, or you get what you pay for, if you will.
Well, Jason, it's good meeting you and having a conversation with you. If people are listening and they want to have a one-on-one, how do they get a hold of you?
Yeah, so feel free to contact me via my email. It's johnet@whitnell.com, or just call me direct at 630-575-2328.
Thank you for coming in today. Appreciate it.
Pleased to be here. Thank you.
Jason Bonet, Senior Vice President, Portfolio Manager at Whitnell, which is part of Associated Bank. Jason's our thought leader today. Our conversations happen every Thursday here on The Opening Bell. You can find more of them over at associatedbank.com/thought leadership, where you can meet our thought leaders as well.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning again, everyone. Welcome back to the program. It's Thursday here in The Opening Bell. The Trump administration formally notified the United Nations earlier this week it was withdrawing the United States from the Paris Agreement on climate change. And what happens next? What does that mean going forward? Joining us this morning is Andrew Light, Distinguished Senior Fellow at the WRI Global Climate Group. That's the World Resources Institute, heading up the climate group there, Senior Fellow. Andrew, good morning. Welcome to the broadcast. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning, Steve.
I want to begin with that simple question. We all knew this was coming. What does it mean now going forward?
Well, with the United States out of the Paris Agreement, we're now the only country that's actually not contributing to the global effort to try to do something about this problem. I think the impacts are going to be pretty bad on the United States. One of the things that we're really concerned about is how this will impact American businesses, especially those who are trying to compete in a new global marketplace where dozens and dozens of countries are trying to transform their energy supplies and increase resilience. There was one study on this done by the International Finance Corporation, which is part of the World Bank Group, a few years ago, which counted up the commitments from the top 21 developing countries under the Paris Agreement, and the and they concluded that it results in the creation of a $23 trillion investment opportunity between now and 2030. Well, as you might imagine, countries with a lot of capacity, like the United States, have been really trying to position themselves to compete in that market, but now you've got the U.S. turning its back on the world, and that will be noticed.
And so how will this work in the real-world situation? Will companies that have that international presence be banned from taking part in that, or will they still be able to take part? Will they have to have different sets of rules for different countries they operate in?
Well, anyone can compete in any markets and try to attract business. The problem is that, what we used to do in previous administrations was we would use things like the Export-Import Bank of the United States or the Overseas Private Investment Corporation to help to create a secure environment for American businesses and also to guarantee that you would use American labor to pursue these opportunities. The United States doesn't do that anymore because our official position is climate change isn't real, and the United States doesn't want to cooperate with other countries on the solution. While lots of other countries, Germany, France, the UK, Canada, others, don't have those same problems, aren't operating under those same constraints, and they are using all of their institutions to help to create a more secure investment opportunity to put their businesses at the front of the line.
I want to talk more about that $23 trillion number in a minute, but first I want to talk a little bit more close to home. So what will businesses and workers, employees in the Chicago area, how will this impact them moving forward?
Well, I think the impacts are going to vary from region to region, but like I said, especially all of those types of businesses that are involved in production of energy efficiency technologies, especially in the export market, those that are interested in heavy construction, especially, and getting contracts in other markets, and there's certainly a lot of heavy construction companies in the Chicago area, that wanted to try to participate in bids for enhancing resilience in other countries, you're just not going to have the help of the United States government to get there, whereas, your competitors across the border are.
Polls, the recent surveys on this show an overwhelming number of American voters want the federal government to be doing more on climate change. Have you ever seen a situation like this where you have such significant public support for something that the government just doesn't believe in?
No, I think, actually never have. I mean, I've certainly seen divisions in, between polling and government action where people disagree on the solution, but never the existence of a problem itself. And I think that's what's really striking here. President Trump announced originally he was intended to withdraw from the Paris Agreement on June 1st, 2017. And since then, every year we've done polling on it, support for the Paris Agreement has actually increased. So it's now 70% of all Americans support U.S. Interaction and participation in the Paris Agreement, and 60% of Republicans do as well. So this really, there's kind of no explaining from that perspective why the U.S. would pull out of agreement, especially an agreement which, the United States basically sets its own target in this agreement and decides what it's going to do. Nothing was forced on us by the rest of the world, as the president has maintained.
Yeah, but still the numbers here are, I guess if you wanted to look for a bright spot, you could look at the different cities and states that have said that they're going to continue on with some of the ideals of the climate agreement, the Paris Climate Agreement. 25 governors,
yes.
A number of cities, including Chicago, on that list. Can they make the difference that having the federal government involved would make?
Well, they can do a lot, and you know, our estimates are that the states and cities and business leaders, university presidents, who have committed to action on the Paris Agreement is incredibly large. In fact, if you put them all together and you made them their own separate country, it would be the second largest economy in the world. So first, the U.S. total economy, then, you know, this collection of leaders who are still in, you know, and still trying to achieve the targets under Paris. And third would be China. So they can do quite a lot. But my organization, the World Resource Institute, and a number of others are going to be releasing a major report next month, which is going to demonstrate that while they can do a lot, you still absolutely need the federal government to reengage if you're going to see the United States hit its original trajectories of where it wanted to be by, say, mid-century. So you actually, you're going to essentially need federal reengagement working with the states and cities, but states and cities can't do this alone.
Andrew, you mentioned earlier that some of the investment opportunities here are tremendous. In emerging markets, $23 trillion in climate investment opportunities. Nearly 189 countries have submitted plans of how they plan to target climate and come up with solutions. That's a lot of money, and we're always told that the investors will follow the money, that policy will follow the money. Do you think that might be the case here as well?
Well, I think that sort of in some respects investors are already following the money, and that most smart investors and most major industries in the U.S. actually would like to participate in these markets and are supporting action in the U.S. under the Paris Agreement. But again, you know, one of the things that countries around the world do, and everybody does it, is we try to create secure investment opportunities by creating loan guarantees and other kinds of programs so that investors in the United States can invest with confidence, can know that when they start a project in another country, they can get their investment out and recoup on the investment that they make and the profits that they're competing for. And unfortunately, the United States, again, is just not doing that kind of thing anymore. You know, we've even seen some indication that some of our embassies around the world are not being even encouraged and indeed are being discouraged from having conversations with governments about the kinds of new energy and resilience projects that they want to undertake and that they're on the record wanting to undertake as part of their Paris commitment. It's very hard to understand why we would put ourselves at a disadvantage when the entire rest of the world is moving in that direction.
Yeah, and even some not necessarily rich countries. I mean, we have some developing countries doing some amazing work on developing low-carbon cities and having some smart agriculture mm-hmm. programs, sustainable forest management. Talk to us about some of those initiatives.
Well, they're absolutely enormous. One of the countries that I know the best in terms of the profile of what they're doing is India, which, you know, India is a very large country, but per capita it's very poor. But if you look at what Prime Minister Modi did when he came into office in the spring of 2014, he took the Congress Party's solar targets, which were 25 gigawatts by 2022, and he just, one of the first things he did is increase them right off the bat to 100 gigawatts, and on top of that added another 75 gigawatts of wind and geothermal and small hydro. Now, when Prime Minister Modi did that, a lot of people thought, well, that seems kind of impossible because he wants to go to 100 by 2022, and in 2014, India had around somewhere between 2 and 4 gigawatts of installed solar capacity. So this was an enormous commitment. But we've really seen India make a lot of progress there. And just look again and again in the forest sector, in the climate resilience sector, in agriculture, you see huge plans by countries like India to try to move forward and make themselves more climate resilient because they look at the science and they don't doubt it. I mean, they're already seeing climate impacts on the ground now, and they know they have to go through a major transformation to make sure that these future climate impacts do not actually cause a rollback of all of the advantages and the advances they've made on development for the last 20, 30 years.
Yeah, and I was recently at a job event where the folks were talking, we had a number of different industries were there, and they were talking about just the jobs that this is creating. The clean energy economy in the U.S. already employs about 3.4 million Americans, and the advice was if you want a job that's going to hold for the future, go into clean energy.
Well, I think that's right. You know, I mean, one of the tragedies, that we see in this is also the way the president has, I think, sold a false bill of goods, for example, to coal mining communities, and has said that he sort of blamed the loss of jobs and the decline in the labor force in coal mining on regulations from previous administrations, when nothing could be further from the truth. What's hurt coal mining jobs is the rise of natural gas. And as the price of energy and renewable energy drops, you're going to see the same kind of thing, transformation happening there. The markets are heading in this direction. You know, this is an administration that's not going to, we hope, interfere with those kinds of trends, but they're certainly not doing anything right now to open up these opportunities for those who want to invest.
Andrew, we appreciate you being on with us this morning and sharing this information and your analysis. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Steve.
Andrew Light, a distinguished senior fellow at WRI, Global Climate Group. That's the World Resources Institute, and you can find them online at WRI.org. That's WRI.org.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
On the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, futures are pointing toward opening gains on Wall Street this morning. Dow futures are up 0.5%, nearly 150 points. S&P and NASDAQ futures up about 0.5% as well. After a generally positive trading day in Asia and a positive trading day underway in Europe. Let's get the latest on agriculture and commodities now. Good morning, Orion Samuelson.
Good morning, Steve. Well, as you look at agricultural markets and Wall Street, the China-U.S. trade deal is still a factor. And that's the concern that grain traders had at the Chicago Board of Trade yesterday. They're worried over the interim China trade deal and also U.S. harvest that's moving along pretty well, and that put a downward pressure on the grain market yesterday. Except wheat. Wheat managed to close up 1.75 cents a bushel, but December corn was down 3 cents, and November soybeans down 6.75 cents in yesterday's trade. Livestock, well, there too. Lean hog futures went lower as the interim China trade deal is yet again delayed, and the delay followed news that Canada is set to resume pork exports to China following a four-month halt amid diplomatic tensions, and a deal by China's agency to buy $100 million of European pork. That sent the lean hog market for February down $1.15. The December live cattle contract down 27 cents, and the November feeder cattle contract ended the day down 87 cents a hundredweight. More on that China situation. Pork imports in China are expected to peak in 2022. Global meat shippers have 3 years to make the most of the outbreak of that fatal pig disease, African swine fever, in China before Chinese pork imports will peak. That's according to a report released by the U.S. pork industry yesterday. That's agribusiness for today. Have a great day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Thanks, Orion. You as well. Developing business story this morning. Nielsen, the media research firm famous for its radio and TV ratings, says this morning it plans to split into two independent publicly traded companies. The company says it will spin off its Global Connect business from its global media unit. The announcement coming this morning from CEO David Kenny, in a statement, says the decision to separate the companies marks a milestone in a strategic evolution for the company, will best position each to serve specific needs of their clients, successfully address rapidly changing dynamics in the marketplace. Following the separation, Kenny will stay on as chief executive of the global media business. A search for a CEO of the Global Connect business will commence. You may have heard earlier this week, Kroger launching a rebranding campaign that will include a new logo and slogan. The grocery store chain that previously did not have a slogan announced its new tagline will be Fresh for Everyone. Kroger's vice president of marketing, Mandy Rassi, says branding plays a critical role in the retail industry because it lets consumers know you who you are and what you stand for. The mass media campaign will include free grocery pickup for customers through January 1st of next year. Kroger says they're not changing the names of local banners like Ralph's, Harris, Teeter, Fred Meyer, and here in the Chicago area, Mariano's. Now the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk outlook for this Thursday, November the 7th. Siemens, Disney, AMC Entertainment, Keurig, Dr. Pepper, SeaWorld, Activision Blizzard, Booking Holdings, GoPro, Lionsgate Entertainment, and Yelp, all among the companies reporting quarterly financial earnings today. On the economic reports calendar, jobless claims out. First initial jobless claims. Also today, the EIA natural gas report. A report on consumer credit and money supply coming as well. Number of Fed speakers out on monetary policy and interest rates, including Rafael Bostic and also Robert Kaplan. So plenty of things that could move the markets on this Thursday, November the 7th.